You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for September 13th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the New York Times op-ed slush pile, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
So, Friday the 13th of 2013, if you're superstitious in any way, we apologize ahead of time for this podcast.
Should I explain what a slush pile is?
Yeah, explain why the New York Times slush pile is, op-ed slush pile is a big deal this week.
Yeah, because, well, the slush pile is, if you operate a magazine, you get lots of unsolicited contributions. And those tend to be called the slush pile. And you might find two or three that are serviceable in every 100 or 200. Mm-hmm. I have lived many a year in everyone else's slush pile, yeah. So I understand what it is. And
usually there's an intern that reads them first.
Yeah.
And moves it up the scale of, you know, if it's worthy, then some sub editor will read it. This is at big magazines.
And if you're Gardner Dojois at Asimov's. You read the first paragraph.
Done.
Yeah, maybe a page. So you get a tiny fraction of a percent of the actual story read by somebody, and then if it catches their attention and seems worthwhile, then it moves up the food chain. And this week,
I was going to say, if you're Alec Baldwin or Vladimir Putin,
yeah.
They might move you up a little faster, yeah. And apparently in the case of Putin, they did.
They did. This is what happens when David Brooks goes on book leave. They just start hiring anybody. Bill Kristol's not available. What about Vladimir Putin? Yeah, that's good. And the problem was he wrote a very good op-ed.
He did write a fairly good op-ed, although it did contain a very convenient lie about chemical weapons, which... You know, hey, if Bush can do it, why not?
it contained a whole bunch of lies about a whole bunch of things, but it was written by, I got to believe it was staffed out to a lot of
people. Oh, yeah. And I think it was brought up at one of the MSNBC shows yesterday that, you know, Obama better get some speechwriters working on an op-ed for the Russian newspaper, for La Pravda, you know.
Well, right now. At this moment, Tom Friedman is slapping the shit out of his own interns going, why can't you do this for me?
And Putin really did nail it on the head about American exceptionalism, how dangerous that is.
Yeah.
And let's face it, we had a perfect illustration of how dangerous American exceptionalism is with Michelle Bachmann actually going to Egypt.
Yeah.
With her friends.
Louis Gohmert
and Iowa... Congressman, his name, it's Peter King is the Northeast moderate Republican, according to Chuck Todd.
Yeah.
And Steve King is the Iowa congressman lunatic who accompanied Michelle Bachmann to Egypt to talk about how we know who is responsible for 9/11. All right. Let's talk about which party wants to cut food stamps.
Yeah, let's guess. Shall we play another edition of Guess Which Party?
And cutting food stamps, you know, to children, the elderly, and the disabled pretty much says it all. Yeah. I did want to go back and read something that's at number 8 on our notes because it's related to the economy and underemployment and wealth. And the wealth distribution in 2012... in terms of income, was actually worse than it's ever been since 1917. It's
over
50%.
Unless you're the top
10% of the top earners control 50% of the income, over 50%.
So if you're in that group, we apologize. It's the best it's been since 1917. You're doing great. Congratulations. You're doing just great.
Well, on Tumblr, there is a Tumblr blog called Sex Pigeon that I discovered this week.
Wow.
And they had clipped out a little paragraph from a New York Magazine article, a puff piece, I would call it, about an online eyeglasses seller named Warby Parker.
Okay.
And Warby Parker is one of these companies that's trying to make shopping into a new experience by you order 5 pair of eyeglasses and then they send them to you and you try them on and decide what you want, send them back to Warby Parker, and Warby Parker fulfills your order for your prescription glasses, but you get to try them on at home. Wow. And the whole point of Warby Parker doing this, they are transforming marketing, they say, because with these 5 pair of glasses, you obviously, as a millennial, will take selfies of yourself wearing these glasses and ask your friends to decide for you which ones look best on social media, right?
Yeah.
So the whole point of this exercise is to get your product being talked about on social media, and therefore you will succeed in selling it. And so one of the CEOs in this New York magazine, this is going somewhere. I want our liberal listeners to know.
Hang on.
The CEO said, when we talked to our friends and looked at macro trends, particularly of the millennials, the number one goal of everybody is not to live a life of just buying a bunch of very expensive objects. I think today people would rather go see the mountain gorillas in Rwanda and have an amazing experience and tell their friends about it. That has more social capital than, you know, taking a private plane to Saint-Tropez.
Yeah.
They figured that traditional advertising wouldn't work with this market. So we tried to come up with creative ideas that were different and interesting enough that someone wants to share with their social network. Or they're going to a dinner party and they want to bring up this conversation because it's just different and unexpected, says Gilboa, the other CEO of this company. Basically, we're trying to find as many opportunities to tell our story. And I titled this paragraph, Why We Need a 90% Tax Bracket. But, you know, it reminded me so much of a conversation you and I have had before about Davos.
Yes.
And how the people of Davos, and then there's the left behind people.
Yes.
The solution that the people at Davos have, who always have a fallback position of wealthy friends and wealthy connections. You know, Arianna Huffington is never going to miss a meal.
No.
You know, and she's never going to not have some place to publish. Tina Brown will always find a way to get paid, as one of Barry Lawyer guy on Twitter replied to you.
Always find a new way to spend Barry Diller's money.
Barry Diller's money, and she'll get paid. Next week, she'll get paid. Trust me. So those kinds of folks, their solution for large-scale economies is, well, everybody needs to become an entrepreneur.
Sure.
You know, and sell their creativity. And
Tom Friedman. Absolutely. Right. Tom Friedman's line of bullshit. Yeah.
Tom Friedman's line of bullshit is, if everyone starts a business and becomes an entrepreneur, that then, you know, the cream will rise to the top and everyone will have enough success and will have this creative revolution and it'll be great. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about that and this paragraph and realizing that there is a movie out there about a society and an economy where everyone is an entrepreneur and everyone is broke. Do you know what that movie is?
Soylent Green.
Close.
Yeah.
Not close at all.
Uh-huh.
It's Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In Napoleon Dynamite, which is one of the funniest movies ever made, in my personal opinion. I just love it.
Uh-huh.
But think about those characters. Napoleon's grandmother has a llama that she's raising, clearly for
something.
I would assume. Uncle Rico is selling Tupperware.
Uh-huh.
He gets Kip riled up in this get-rich-quick scheme to go door-to-door and sell this, you know, food storage. Unbreakable food storage. And then he switches over to breast enhancement pills.
Because he's, you know, you can't keep him down.
Yeah. And then there's Napoleon's quasi-girlfriend, Deb.
Right.
She's always going door to door with, you know,
bracelets, right?
Keychains and hand wovens that she's made to finance her college education door to door. And they're in the middle of Idaho.
Right.
So where there's nothing, I mean, it's so barren and so empty. And there is, you know, I found it wonderful that, you know, what Napoleon's opportunity to remake himself is to go buy a brown suit at the Goodwill. You know, that's how he reforms himself. into something new. I also wanted to point out something I found out today in researching this, that in April of 2005, the Idaho legislature approved a resolution commending the filmmakers of Napoleon Dynamite. Specifically enumerating the benefits the movie had brought to Idaho, as well as for showcasing various aspects of Idaho's culture and economy.
Yeah, they sure did, too.
They sure did.
Best damn dance culture on the West Coast, frankly.
And apparently that high school in Idaho is a tourist attraction now. I'm not surprised. But Napoleon Dynamite, that's what it looks like when everyone's an entrepreneur. Cool. And you've cut food stamps, and you've cut all housing opportunities, you've cut educational opportunities for average Americans, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like Napoleon Dynamite.
Can I take Davos? Can I take a giant leap, a sideways leap, from exactly that point to Frank Herbert, the Dose of Dye experiment, and Dune, and slavery?
You're going to blow my mind.
I thought
I was going to blow your mind.
You did blow my mind, because Napoleon Dynamite, you just threw that out there.
I did.
And I sat back in awe and watched you weave this word picture of the pure entrepreneurial society.
Yeah.
In Frank Herbert, the Dose of Dye experiment, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing, and Dune, you had secret armies or secret cultures that were being deliberately experimented upon by taking away their food, increasing social pressure, just making life harder and harder and harder for those people. And in one case, it was part of an experiment. In another case, it was part of the ecology of the planet Arrakis, the planet Dune. It's incredibly difficult life. You might think of that's where I jump over to slavery too. The secret terror of white people. I will now tell you the secret terror of white people. Draw close to the speaker, kiddies. I'll tell you the secret fear of white people, especially white men, is if they had to endure hundreds of years of chattel slavery and murder and terror, they wouldn't cut it.
Mm-hmm.
They'd fold like a cheap suit.
Oh, if they had to go into labor.
Yeah.
Or have a menstrual cycle, they wouldn't make it.
And the terror is that the people that years of hardship and deprivation and murder and terror produced are better people than they are.
Mm.
They're stronger than they are. They're smarter than they are. They're more capable of surviving. All the virtues that rugged individualists tout from their Barca loungers are the virtues that people who survived slavery practiced, because they actually did survive. They survived hundreds of years of the kind of abuse that weekend warriors couldn't possibly fucking imagine. I couldn't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So you can induce a society to produce brilliant, capable survivalist individuals, but you have to crush that society to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kill 90% of the people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to induce a brutal Darwinian cycle so that only the most fit survive. And I'm not saying that that is something we should do, but there's a certain virtue in the idea of this little town in Idaho producing people who fail and try again.
Yep.
And they fail
keep
and try again.
About them, yeah.
And they just keep going.
Yep.
And put that person in New York, they might do really well. Because they've learned how to fail and try again and try again and try again. But you never want to go out of your way to create a society that forced people to suffer just so eventually you want a society that teaches people discipline and teaches people not to abuse their privilege as citizens,
mm-hmm.
not to overuse the planetary resources that we all have, but to be arbitrarily sadistic.
Yeah.
In the service of, this is the old, kick them till they learn better.
Mm-hmm.
Got to beat them till they get good character.
Yeah.
No, you produce a second generation of abusers is what you do there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the idea of teaching discipline is what Boy Scouts is about, and that you can survive failure and get up from it again. But the idea that there's any relationship between a Tina Brown failure.
Yes.
And a poor person failure.
Right. Yep.
The idea that if Tom Friedman fucks up horribly and gets fired from one of his many jobs that he should never have had in the first place is like the single mother or father losing their part-time job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if they were just pluckier and and tried a little harder and work those phone calls, work those contacts, eventually someone on the Pulitzer board will give you a job doing something useful.
You know, someone at Sally Quinn's birthday party would be happy to hire you.
Sure. And when that is that's the limits of your thinking.
Yep.
That, well,
yep.
You just have to keep working your Rolodex until one of your friends from Harvard who has their business.
Yeah.
Will find a place for you. They'll sit on your board. And
yeah. And you only have to consult for them anyway, because, you know. Yeah.
And I believe me, I know people like this.
Yeah.
I have been around people like this. Yep. Some of them are very nice. Some of them are not. But the idea that one of the virtues of the Kennedy family, I would argue, is that they had the self-awareness to know how fucking privileged they were.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that public service, real public service, is the price that we pay for having everything.
Yep.
For having this.
And you know that was Rose Kennedy. That was nobody but Rose Kennedy doing that. And that stayed on for generations. And this youngest generation of Kennedys isn't interested, for the most part, is not interested in holding public office. They're all interested in using their wealth and their name and their voice to improve the environment, mm-hmm. improve life for poor people that need home heating oil, that kind of thing. And it's public service.
But now take all those people and just decapitate from them any sense of public duty,
mm-hmm.
and you have libertarians.
Yeah, yeah.
You have white, male, privileged libertarians,
mm-hmm.
who really believe the world was here to make my living, and there's nothing wrong with if you're just plucky enough, you won't be poor. And therefore, if you're poor, it's your own damn fault. Therefore, I don't need to feel bad about cutting food stamps for you. Because what you really need is to have your life made a little bit harder. And eventually you'll
snap out. So that you work more. Yes.
So you work more.
It's fascinating to me that the win by Bill de Blasio this week mm-hmm. is being held up by people in the media. Particularly, there was an article in the Daily Beast of all places by Peter Beinart saying the rise of the new left. This is the end of the Clinton-Reagan. No, really, I'm not making that up. The Clinton-Reagan era. And it's a challenge, of course, to Hillary Clinton. She's got to start worrying. There are so many lunches to be bought on what Hillary Clinton needs to worry about.
Yeah. Well, Chris Matthews should just change the name of his show.
So true.
To the Hillary Clinton Pinata Hour. Because every time you wax, that candy falls out.
It's so true. And I want to talk about Digby. You had some fascinating things to say at lunch,
well,
on the way back from lunch.
Yeah.
About Digby. So let's get into what Digby had to say. This is in relation to Syria and Obama.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. Tell us about Digby.
Digby, if you're unfamiliar with the history of the left.
And the history of the blogosphere. She's very critical to that.
She is. She's one of the people who were in the early blogosphere people were shocked to discover was a woman, in the same way that people were shocked to discover Stephen Gilliard was black. because they're both, Steve Gilliard is, of course, deceased. Really good writers.
Mm-hmm.
Passionate, smart, insightful. And the phrase, what Digby said, became the cheap
laugh line of several daily posts, yearly posts.
Oh, but it also became what 80% of everyone else wrote.
Yeah.
At one point, pretty much 90% of the left, I'm being a little cruel, and these are my people, and so I'm allowed to do that. About 90% of the left.
Let's say there was a tier of blogging that was very much 100% original content and original analysis.
Yes.
And Digby was part of that.
There were
a lot of bloggers, a lot of people who got their own blog,
uh-huh.
who were doing it for fun or vanity or part-time or whatever,
uh-huh.
and linking to Digby and saying what Digby says was their version of blogging. And it became a trope.
And
there were blogs out there that for the most part did that.
Well, they alternated because every other post was fuck Bush.
Yes.
And with no actual sort of argument why that was relevant. It was just he's an awful man and saying fuck Bush makes me a blogger.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
we're, like you say, we're dissing on our own people here.
We are.
But it's fascinating to me to see the number of blogs that no longer exist.
Yes.
At all.
Yes. And how the changes, this is very inside baseball. We won't bore you with it. But the number of blogs that have changed
mm-hmm.
a lot
mm-hmm.
in the last 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And so Digby was back when there was a Koufax Award.
Yeah.
They just used to hand that to her every year as best writer.
And she's still going strong, and she's a great writer and a friend of Crooks and Liars and doing wonderful work. I love the work she's doing for fundraising for Democratic progressive candidates, particularly in House races. She's really doing a good work there.
And
so
her blog still looks the way it did 8 years ago.
Yeah.
She hasn't upgraded the technology, so bless her heart. She has become
She's still on Blogspot, isn't she?
I think
Is she? That I would have to check.
And she's... But physically hasn't changed. There's two changes to her blog that are probably slightly relevant to what I'm about to say. One is she's become a group blog. Mm-hmm. She has more than one person blogging at her site. So she is no longer a single shingle shop, which is neither here nor there, but it's interesting to me. The second is she turned comments off, which I find kind of disappointing. She had a technical glitch a year or so ago.
By the way, she still is Blogspot, and Jesus General is still on Blogspot. So
yeah, and me too.
Turn their nose up at Blogspot. Need to realize how old school it is.
Yeah, but Digby stopped accepting comments. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a lot of Hillary and Obama and a lot of infighting involved in that decision, as well as a technical problem. But she's still a good writer, and we have lost the cohesion we had as a movement when Bush was president. Now there are people who fight as hard with each other on the left as they fight against the conservatives and Republicans, which is probably to be expected. It's somewhat dispiriting, but that's the way it goes. Now, that's life in the big city. That's life in the NBA. But Digby wrote a little post recently where she made a request that people stop trying to impute to Barack Obama a 11-dimensional chess master Jedi mind capacity, mm-hmm. Jedi mind trick capacity over Syria.
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't we just admit that he lucked out? Mm-hmm. That there was this misstatement and it was seized upon and they built upon it, and he had the good sense to sort of be flexible and opportunistic enough to take an accidental ace when it fell in his lap and play it wisely. And can we just stop pretending that every time something happens, it's because he planned it out? And I'm perfectly willing to go along with that. I'm perfectly willing to have a president who is smart and flexible enough to take advantage when advantage is given, and who screws up occasionally, who says something stupid in public, or his spokespeople say stupid things in public, and he has to walk them back. Not everything is part of an 11th dimensional chess mm-hmm. game.
Yep.
But by the same token, dear Digby, can we also, because she says this is not healthy, it's not necessary. This it turned out a good thing happened. So mm-hmm. can't we just accept that a good thing happened and stop trying to pretend that his genius had anything to do with it?
Well, and I want to read this paragraph from Digby from that post where she's it's actually 12th dimensional chess. She says, can we please stop pretending that the superhuman is going on here? That's not the case. And her last paragraph, I think, is telling. She said, I don't know why it's so important for people to believe that the president is a Jedi master, but he clearly isn't. Yeah. However, uh-huh. he is willing to change course on foreign policy anyway when an opportunity presents itself.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that, this is Digby saying, I think that's praiseworthy in itself, particularly after our last experience with a stubborn president determined to go to war no matter what. It's a good thing that they can take advantage of an unseen possibility.
Right.
Why the need to make it more than it is? Absolutely right. So, yes, what Digby said.
But then I added.
But then this is your caveat to that.
My caveat is, but I also have to ask why it's so important for other people to believe President Drone Kill McWorse than Bush is a war-hungry sociopath when he clearly isn't.
Yeah.
Why do they need to make it less than it is? Why? Because there really is a very loud, I'm not sure how many they are, but a very loud clique on the left for whom Barack Obama is a skulking, evil sociopath who wants to indiscriminately bomb civilians, especially children.
Mm-hmm.
And goes
to bed at night saying, who can I drone tomorrow?
Yeah, yes. And does it for kicks or for some dark motive that we're never quite led to understand why he would do that, because it seems incredibly stupid.
And it really Bush's does motive feel is, like this flip. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
It really does feel like the flip side of the coin of Barack Obama goes to bed wondering how he can make America more Kenyan.
Yes.
You know, just this seemingly disjointed jump to assume evil in a guy who is not a Jedi Master, who is not Satan, who is not worse than Bush, above all, not worse than Bush. And I don't understand it. I just don't.
So I am perfectly willing to, I hate to be all centristy and all, but I'm perfectly willing to meet halfway. It's the part that some people on my side of the aisle can't see that, because remember, before Russia stepped in, there was a long article in Salon and by David Sirota about how narcissistically evil Barack Obama was, and how he was and this is probably because people in the Pentagon had their budget cuts and they're looking to create another fake war just to jack their budgets up. That's probably why he's doing this. And you know, we can't say for sure, but let's speculate. Let's put that Fox question mark at the end of it.
And you mean cavutoing?
Yes. And it's
well, if you think it's bad now, just wait till Hillary's the front runner again.
Yeah.
It's going to be Vince Foster and Benghazi. They can't put Benghazi away because of Hillary Clinton. That's it. They can't do it. And I don't know how to slap that out of them, because that's
what I would like to do is people who have the credibility of someone like Digby, because I don't have any credibility. I'm an Obot. As
everybody
said,
knows who you are.
I get my instructions faxed to me from the White House every day. Everyone knows that. But if someone on, and I saw this happen briefly. It happened with Charlie Pierce, I think, and Digby, when one of the people on the left just went too far. Mm-hmm. I think it was Glenn Greenwald attacking Rick Perlstein as a tool of imperial power. And you know, really, when you've gotten that drunk that you start lashing out at Rick Perlstein as a tool of the White House, you've really gone off the fucking rails. And someone, since it can't be me, I'd really appreciate if someone on the left would gently encourage in maybe the same sentiment. You know, it's fine the president screwed up and took advantage of an unseen possibility. That's a good thing. And so can't we also agree that he's not Dexter? He's not Norman Bates. He doesn't actually sit up. Because the only way the theory on the left that Barack Obama is unremittingly evil and worse than Bush makes sense is that if he just likes killing people.
Yeah.
And then you work backwards from that crazy ass idea into here's why he did A, B, C, and D. And I'm perfectly willing to accept the fact that he's corrupt occasionally, that he says things in public that ain't true occasionally, that he makes mistakes, that he is way too enamored of executive power. That's the lines in which I am, as a liberal, perfectly willing to have a conversation. But I can't talk to someone who starts off with the theory that, okay, since we know Barack Obama is the devil, what part of his devil's plot must this be? Because then you are just another fucking Glenn Beckite. Then you're just another Limbaugh fan. Then you really have just left the orbit. And there's a disturbingly loud number. I'm not sure how large they are, but a loud number of people on the left who've gone down this rabbit hole. And I don't expect to ever see them again until President Cruz.
Yeah.
At which point I'm sure we'll all make common cause again and suddenly discover that, hey, you know what? Having a competent law professor who spoke in complete sentences for 8 years wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to America. Anyway, moving on.
Oh, you put this in our notes about how my confession this week that I spend 5 minutes a day on Twitter.
I didn't put that in there.
You didn't? Oh.
No.
You mean I typed that in there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I do. Internet privacy. There was a Pew poll about Americans being concerned about internet privacy, but they're much more concerned about criminals and people stealing their identities for money and advertisers or ex-girlfriends than they are about the government. And they're twice as likely to be concerned that employers are spying on them than that law enforcement or the government are spying on them. And I guess the point is that the consequences of that are very apparent.
Yeah.
The reason we bring this up is that there is a lawsuit against Gmail in California that somehow Gmail is reading all of your emails when they're actually just looking for keywords in order to provide advertising that then pays for Gmail.
Right. That's the trade.
Mm-hmm. But that's something that is so easy to forget. It really is the first world privilege that just assumes that your email is your email, just like your home mortgage tax deduction is just something that you get and it doesn't cost anybody else anything. It's just your thing. It's so built, don't it's take built that into away.
The universe. It's a law of the universe.
It's a law of the universe that I mm-hmm. get this. Of course I get this, even for my second home. Of course I get this.
Well, and tomorrow Google wanted to, my blog could disappear.
Yeah. Because that happened to Sandy Underpants for a while because he likes to put the naked happy ladies on his blog every week. Once a
bless,
week,
puts bless
a
him.
Topless a topless lady who's very happy to be there, and
bless him and all who sail upon him.
Right, but that offended just enough people that Google made his blog go away, and he really didn't know where it went. He couldn't get to it, and neither could anyone else. And so that the aristocrats, he appealed and asked and made enough noise and eventually did get it back, but it just disappeared.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be take anything for granted in that arena.
Well, I think, was it Jamie? Was it your friend Jamie? You made a point about spam.
Jamie at Intoxination wrote an article, which I can post to our Facebook page. His blog is called Intoxination, Politics Drunk on Power. He just pointed out, because he's a tech guy, look, Gmail also scans your email for spam and scans your email for phishing, which is trying to steal your private information.
By trickery.
By pretending that they're your bank emailing you. Yeah.
Right.
And so you definitely want them doing that, because if they didn't, you'd have a lot more spam. You'd have a lot more junk going through your email, and you might have your whole computer taken down by a virus.
You'd have an infinite amount of spam.
Yeah.
Because I wrote a million years ago when I had a weekend to kill, I wrote just for fun. I traced the spam. I used to have a thing called a spam catcher on my blog, and it would gobble up all the spam that would come in the door by playing a trick with the post at the head. The lead post, I keep tricking it with a date, and all the spam would gather there, almost all of it. And I got so fascinated because it was thousands of them, just mindless piles of junk. And I spent 48 hours and wrote Fear and Loathing on the Spam Pain Trail, the history of spam, how spam works. And I just did it from my couch using my computer and going through name-changing servers and a server farm in California and a blind drop near an airport in L.A. and another server farm in Russia and this company in Seattle that makes a fortune just keeping the identity of spammers secret. There's a whole economy devoted to just sending you crap. I've had it all boils down to Herbalife for some reason. I don't know why. But for some reason, it all boiled down to Herbalife. And I should probably repost that. It actually got picked up by a couple of trade sites. Spam.
That were interested in spam management.
There's this guy. I don't know who he is, but it's really kind of fascinating. And he's a decent writer. But it was fun. It was a puzzle to be solved. But if there's no guard at your door, spam costs nothing.
At your free house, too. Gmail is free.
Uh-huh.
That's the thing that everyone needs to remember.
Yes. Yahoo is free.
You can go and pay somebody to give you an email account and tell them what to do.
And part of the deal is they use their clever little algorithms to search your email for you and dump your spam into one bucket, what they think is spam, and everything else into one or two or three tabs into another bucket. And they also do the same search for keywords, like you said, to very focus some ads at you.
And to be clear, most people, and this goes back to the NRA having a mailing list as well, most people do not mind advertising that is carefully focused to them and their interests. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the NRA collected, now there should have been a little more transparency there, I'm sure, in terms of when you register your gun, you should be have an opt-out to not give your name and address to the NRA for marketing purposes. Mm-hmm. But people don't mind their name and email or personal information going to advertisers who have products that they are likely to want to purchase or use.
Yeah.
I can testify to that.
Yes. It's eerie.
All of the yarn emails go into my priority box without me even having to ask.
We know what you're knitting and we know how much you need to finish. And we happen to have that in stock right now.
It will ship
it to you for nothing.
But yeah, I don't mind. I mean, you know, and I'm even if I'm not interested in that particular ad, I don't care.
Yeah.
That they're emailing. I don't care at all that they're putting yarn ads up on my email. And most people don't. But if you sue Google, as they are doing in California, with some theory that they are spying on you by gathering up keywords when they're actually de-spamming and providing a revenue stream for their free product. I hope that court case goes away. I really
well,
and I'm not one to defend Google against all enemies, but in this case,
but if you give up one, you give up the other.
Yeah.
And there are private email servers. When I worked in the education sector, mm-hmm. That institution had its own email servers. We had our own email system. Mm-hmm. The department I worked in had its own email server.
Mm-hmm.
So there are alternatives to Gmail.
And actually, Middlechild at the Gifted Magnet School has her own email server, which only allows her to email fellow students and teachers. That's it. It will not allow her to use it outside the school system, which is wonderful for teaching a child email when every adult that's sending her email is an employee of the district who can be fired if they misuse it, you know. Mm-hmm.
But
there's that. Yeah.
And the point of the Pew poll is that, yes, at a very high level, people are concerned about their internet privacy.
Yeah.
But they're way, way more concerned about corporations and stalkers.
Yep. And ex-boyfriends and what and also, yeah, employers spying on you. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of that does happen. And it is true.
Absolutely.
And just as sort of I'm not going to name names, but let's just say that someone has recently scanned and repeatedly scanned the newspaper that has been the location of most of the NSA stories.
Mm-hmm.
The one that has printed most of the NSA stories. It is it's a Guardian newspaper from the United Kingdom. And discovered that every time you go there, it hangs like 12 or 13 bugs.
I do believe it was Bob Seska.
I believe it was Bob Seska look.
There were something like 21 on one of Glenn Greenwald's articles. There were 21 cookies.
Yeah. Or bugs. Just tracking. Tracking software.
Tracking your mouse clicks. Yeah.
And I get that that's not the government and they don't have armies and they can't drone me in my sleep.
They're doing it for advertising because you're going to the Guardian for free and reading their content.
Exactly.
There is a point at which that goes too far. It's called Tina Brown.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I heard her give a speech live about how excited she was to be in internet publishing when she took her Daily Beast. She was at Blogger.
Yeah, you saw her at Blogger.
And it was so offensive to me that the whole focus of her address was, we are going to make advertisers happy and we are going to wrap advertising around content in such a way that it cannot be avoided.
Yeah.
And that is such an exciting development in my world. I can't tell you. So,
well, and she
great,
did.
Great, Tina.
She promised to turn Newsweek around, and she did. She put a lot of porn and weird covers on it before she turned it around and buried it face down.
And folks, you really do need to go and watch our, I think it's 2-year-old video now, a little audio skit of Tina Brown starting a new magazine called Cover.
Yeah.
Which is a totally salacious and hit-grabbing cover and an ad.
And we shall say no more.
Under the front. We won't say any more, but
it involves
the whole magazine is one page.
It involves Hitler. We're going to just say, just leave it at that. There's some Hitler involved. A little bit of Hitler on top of that.
By the way, our Congressman Rodney Davis, Republican from Cole, did write to me.
Really?
Yeah, because he wants to know how to vote on Syria. And he points you in the email to his Syria survey.
Yeah.
You can complete this form here on this webpage or use Facebook. Here's the survey.
Can I ask one question before you start?
Yeah.
Can I have the Syria survey spoken to me by Siri?
Because
that would make me very happy. Yeah.
I can't do a Siri voice, but here it is. Here is the complete survey.
Uh-huh.
Do you believe that the United States should take any military action in Syria? Yes, no, undecided.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
That's it. That's it. Wow. Wow.
I just responded to the survey, and your email address is required. By answering the survey, you are subscribing to my newsletter.
Yeah.
are subscribing to my newsletter.
Remember that the other conversation about Syria that's being had by people literally across the aisle, I've used that word twice, but the actual Republican Party, the actual conservative movement, as run by Rush Limbaugh and Rand Paul, are conducting they're conducting an entirely different conversation.
Yeah.
Rush Limbaugh has referred to Syria as Operation Shuck and Jive.
Yep.
Because shock and awe is for big countries who are powerful, but we're pussies and Barack Obama's an asshole. And it's black, by the way. So let's call it Operation Shuck and Jive, because that'll make my racist fan base happy. Yep. And you know what it seems like to Rush Limbaugh? You know what it seems like? It seems like that maybe, just maybe, Barack Obama is doing this to strengthen Al-Qaeda, because they're really the people who he's backing. See, because he really hates America. And
his secret plan.
And weirdly enough, that's awfully close to what Rand Paul said.
Yeah.
During his pre-recorded remarks, where he decided before Barack Obama said anything what he thought about it. And so that's the other side
of
this.
Stephen Colbert has pointed out that Rand Paul has had a lot of positions on Syria.
Yeah. Oh, it's pretty funny. In one speech.
In one speech.
But that is truly the other side of this conversation. We on the left are arguing about the limits of American power. How shall we atone for the fact that we have screwed up much of the world diplomatically for 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
When I get comments in my comment section, you know, we're talking about Syria, we're talking about whatever action or inaction or mistake or whatever. And I get, yeah, but the Tonkin Resolution, Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. What about fucking Korea, man? And, you know, what about overthrowing Mossadegh? Got it. Can we please hold this president responsible for things that happened at least after he was born?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be okay? Because you're right. There's a long history in the Middle East and all over the world, but especially in the Middle East, of the United States sticking its nose in, doing things that they shouldn't have done, that we shouldn't have done. But I don't know how to, other than getting a time machine, I don't know how to fix that.
Yep.
Because saying that, well, Reagan was cool with poison gas, so why is Barack Obama putting up a stink about it? Well, okay, then everything Reagan did, Barack Obama should get credit for. I don't understand this.
I don't think even in Peggy Noonan's drunkest dreams, she gives Barack Obama credit for anything Reagan did in her drunken dreams.
And that's my problem.
It's
every conversation you have about a discrete and distinct thing that we are contemplating that might very well be a bad idea immediately opens up into, yeah, but look what about Iran-Contra?
Mm-hmm.
What about Cain and Abel?
Yep.
You know, what about the fall of Berlin, man? And it's okay. You don't want to have a conversation about this one distinct thing. You want all the sins that anyone has ever committed piled up high enough to blot the sun out, so that you can say America just sucks.
Yeah.
That
makes certain people think they sound intelligent
and that's
negative, which we've talked about before.
Hey,
Driftglass, yeah. I need to end this podcast and I don't want to end it until we've talked a little bit about sequestration, because we skipped this last week.
We did.
More than 20,000 of Nevada's long-term unemployed lost a whopping 59% of their unemployment insurance payments. Due directly to sequestration,
mm-hmm.
And this needs to go away. It needs to stop. It's a stupid, stupid plan, and we let the Tea Party win on this one, and we've got to undo it. So,
well, if you look at the quote directly above that, why the recovery is sucking so bad,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One of the reasons the recovery is so slow is that the public sector has had, I'm quoting from an article from The Atlantic, has had an unprecedentedly bad post-crash performance.
Absolutely. Yep.
In every other recovery going back three decades, the public sector has grown, often grown by millions of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
However, in this recovery, the public sector has collapsed by hundreds of thousands of workers. And I would argue not just that, but all of the, as I've said before, all of the agencies and affiliates that government funds that aren't actually directly employed by them, those people have laid people off. So there's this ripple effect that is being kept low deliberately by sequestration and austerity and a desire to make sure the government – this is them shrinking the government to the point where they can drown in the tub.
In the bathtub, right.
And
Grover Norquist, yes.
It's hurting real people every day, and it's getting worse every day. And what we're seeing in the next month or two is the fight over the debt limit is coming up.
So ridiculous.
And get ready for another hostage drama, because you will see defund Obamacare or we will, by God, let the government go broke. We will, by God, default on our credit.
And that's the point where Obama just needs to say, I'm going to work to impeach anybody who does that. And by the way, I'm instructing the Treasury Department to print money and continue to pay our debts, regardless of what you vote.
So
and
you're in favor of the fascist Barack Obama overruling the
Congress,
will
yes.
of the people.
Yeah,
and,
no, the Congress, yeah.
And,
the
and,
worst
well,
Congress in history.
Yeah, yep. but that's... Hello. It's what you're arguing for. And I'm in agreement with you. Let me make sure I put my agreement voice on. What you're saying is Barack Obama should rule as a imperial dictator and just rule by fiat because, you know, he and you know, because he's worse than Bush. I'm sure he'll find it easy to do that.
Well, and I did want to say, you know, the August issue of the New Republic had a cover story. It's the austerity stupid. And that's exactly what we're talking about with the government. Spending dropping so sharply that it extends the failure of the economy to grow. And that's what's happening.
And if, you know,
I think you've said something along the lines of liberals were right all along.
Yeah. Well, and I would go off on my extended musing on Glenn Beck, who I listen to now that I drive around in beautiful central Illinois. But one of the things that Glenn Beck, of all people, said today was hilarious. It was, well, after Syria goes to hell and World War III is launched and real people start feeling pain from this guy, they'll look around for answers to who's to blame and what went wrong. And Vladimir Putin is setting himself up as a person who can answer those questions. But his theory was once people realize how badly person X screwed up or movement X screwed up, they will go looking for answers to what was broken about that and they will try to fix it. And I just started laughing in my car because we had 8 years of nothing but fuck-ups under George Bush. And the people who voted him in, voted to re-elect him, and applauded him every inch of the way have in no way backed away from their bad theories of government, their stupid foreign policy decisions. They simply pretended it never happened. They never voted for George Bush. Iraq was not my decision. I never voted for him or Iraq shipped those chemical weapons to Syria. And so the idea that anybody but a liberal is ever going to change their mind based on new information is a bad way to proceed in the governing business, because there's a whole bunch of people on the other side of our aisle who will trash the federal government on purpose, make it ungovernable. And the minute the president tries to do anything to keep the country running, they will impeach him for being a dictator because they've deliberately sabotaged the government, made it impossible for him to govern any other way. That is to be expected. What disturbs me is I'm pretty sure a whole lot of liberals will join in the chorus.
Yep.
Because worse than Bush. Anyway, each week.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Tigger, who, I apologize, has been waiting a year to be Internet Kitty of the Week. My apologies, Tigger. Next week, we have another Internet Kitty who was lost in my email. I'm going to catch up with those. We also have, by my most recent count, 26 new Internet Kitties that have been sent in the past week.
Yeah.
And thank you so much. That's 6 months of Internet Kitties for us, and we'll be sharing those each week, as we always do.
Which is really too bad, because like Breaking Bad, we only have 3 episodes left. And
no,
we
don't.
That's right. In 3 episodes, it'll be our 200th episode.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna last at least 5 years, because Rachel Maddow has lasted 5 years. So if she can do it, we can do it.
Sure.
Congratulations, Rachel Maddow, on your 5-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Feel free to write us. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can write to both of us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any address, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Oh, Blue Gal, the internet kitties are so looking forward to David Brooks being forced to refer to Vladimir Putin as my respected colleague.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Jif Glass.
University. We need jingles. We want to wish a happy birthday to one of our listeners. His name is Raymond. He sends us lots of science fiction books and supports our podcast and regularly, and we really appreciate all he does for us. And happy birthday, Raymond. It's his birthday this weekend. And he has some Science Fiction University questions for you. Number one, Harlan Ellison was in Babylon 5 at least once.
Bite me.
I'm thinking, however, of the last episode with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. What was Harlan Ellison dressed as? And or what did he do in that episode of Babylon 5?
As I recall, he was dressed as Zelig. And no, I do remember him being in the series. I don't remember him being in that part, in that scene, which is killing me. He was, I believe, he played the part of a computer. He actually was the voice of the computer. He did a lot of background writing for it, did some, I think he was called the creative consultant, but he was also the voice of the computer. So I'm going to give myself a point for knowing that, which I'm pretty sure is right. But I don't know
In the last episode, he was a psychop, and he closed the door.
That makes sense.
In the last episode of Quantum Leap, Dr. Beckett leapt to a bar. It had a big, burly Irishman as the bartender. What was the name of the bar?
Yeah, that's Callahan's.
Yeah, how did you know that? What's the significance of Callahan's?
Callahan's Crosstime Saloon is Spider Robinson's made-up
Robinson story. Yeah,
it's not a story. It's a bar where he sets lots and lots of short stories. Lots of the extraterrestrials and time. There's a book called Time Traveler Strictly Cash. As you could imagine, that might be the case. And several other books about Callahan's, Callahan's Bar, Callahan's Lady. And it's where people go to find redemption. And you can't find it unless you really need to.
That's a hat tip to everything that Spider Robinson wrote about Callahan's.
Absolutely it is.
All right. Opinion question. You mentioned the number of the beast last time with all the Spot the Heinleins. I had been thinking about the craft, the Gay Deceiver. How it could eventually travel to other dimensions, bigger on the inside than outside, and pilots changed around, with eventually being in the Long family, so they had rejuvenations whenever.
Right.
And with the help of Dora, could travel in time as well. I think this was about the same time Sylvester McCoy was looking for a new job. So, did Robert Heinlein channel all the Doctor Who fan base, or did he get asked to write a movie script for it that was rejected, so he used it in the book? Was it all just coincidence? Or, as you have always told me many, many times, does everybody steal from Heinlein?
Well, Doctor Who's been around for 50 years, and The Number of the Beast was in the 80s, I think. And the Number of the Beast was a bad book. I believe Robert Heinlein got more money for that book than anybody had ever gotten before. He got like the best publishing contract to date for that book anyone had ever heard of. And everyone was looking forward to it because everybody I knew at the time was all caught up on their Heinlein. And it was, but he was having, I think, brain problem. I mean, literally having
a physical problem. Right.
And it really was.
Not that mental illness isn't a real illness. We get that. But he was having serious health problems.
He was. And he recovered from them for a time and wrote some really good books.
Yeah.
He wrote Friday After That, which I think was a very good book. But his stuff has a sort of cavalier gallant sweetness to it. That's fine in small doses, but if you have it in large bites, it's just saccharine and bad. And what Heinlein clearly wanted to do, I think, was pretty clear. He wanted to loop in all of his other characters. He wanted to loop in Jonathan Hoag from a collection of short stories from the 40s and 50s. He wanted to loop in everybody he's ever written about in every short story anywhere into a giant multiverse of Robert Heinlein's stuff and make them all part of one grand scheme, which is fine. That's a noble effort. I mean, he did that with Future History. You know, he on a chalkboard, he wrote out what the history is likely going to be for the next several thousand years in some detail and pulled sections of that out and wrote about them. And that was a successful way of sort of keeping your stories hanging together, sort of, kind of, except, you know, he always strayed from that you didn't feel constrained by that. Mm-hmm. But this was I'm pretty clear that this was Highline's effort to just pile everybody into the van and go for a drive. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to do that without inventing a completely cockamamie plot device mm-hmm. called the Gay Deceiver.
Yeah, that lets people travel in time and space and be related and change and regenerate and all of that in order to be in all these different stories. Yeah, yeah.
And the number of the beast was six rays of the sixth power, rays of the sixth powers, I recall. That was the number of multiverses or universes that were available to the person who cracked the code on how to do this. And it was a fine effort, but I think it was just Heinlein wanted one last trip into his path through tomorrow and to bring everything full circle, and he didn't pull it off. And it was kind of sad.
And finally, Raymond has just a comment for you about Babylon 5.
Yeah.
If it weren't for the television execs getting involved and messing things up, Babylon 5 would have been a lot better. But still, it was the best. It didn't help that Star Trek did BS9 at the same time. Between the two, you can get the real full story after all. But oh well. Battlestar Galactica was done much better than the original series. I always looked at it like it was an old U.S. World War II aircraft carrier in the South Pacific against the Japanese fleet.
Yep.
Hawaii had gotten wiped out, and they were looking for the United States, but they kept being in the area of Australia. But that was just me, as far as I know. The new series, about all I rewatch, is the pilot and the last episode. Everything else was just filler. And thank you for that, Raymond. And were you a big Babylon 5 fan when it was on the air?
I was. The first season was hard to watch because it really was pretty wooden. Mm-hmm. And then it got better. Mm-hmm. And some of it really was elegant. Some of it was mm-hmm. really, really quite magnificent. And the way it we're talking about Babylon 5, not Battlestar Galactica, right?
Right. No, we're talking about Babylon 5. Yeah.
Yeah. Babylon 5 had nice big ideas mm-hmm. about good and evil and how they play themselves out in the universe and what and you think you're advanced, and imagine if you're in this sort of collective of advanced races, all of whom have space travel and all of whom have, there's faster than light portals. You know, you know ships might be able to jump from point to point, but there's an entire alternate universe or an entire extra dimension through which you travel, and things live in that dimension. Mm-hmm. And all of your cares and woes and all the fights you have, the civil wars, the genocide, all of that is trivial compared to the stuff that's way out there.
Yeah.
The races that are a billion
the
years
big
old.
Problem. Yeah.
The stuff that the people, the creatures that have been walking around since the beginning of time. The idea that the universe exists at that scale mm-hmm. is something that it had.
And that's very Asimov-like.
It is. Well. It really, really is.
Yeah, we are a speck, and there are creatures in the universe so far beyond our comprehension that are out there. Yeah.
And so Star Trek rarely touches that.
Yeah.
The villains that they encounter, I mean, there was a couple of episodes.
Everyone's human.
And the problems, you know, the weapons are all sort of on the same scale. The enemies are all sort of evenly matched. There's a couple of cases where humans encounter incredibly advanced races, but they're all, you know, it's Clint Howard.
Yeah.
You know, it's 5-year-old Clint Howard in a giant spaceship, and he's going to invite us on and he'll have his voice overdubbed by Orson Welles, apparently. And in the end, it wasn't that menacing at all. But basically, the villains are humans with, you know, stuff on their forehead, which is at the limits of, I understand that's the limits of special effects.
A makeup budget. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the idea that the one episode, the alternate pilot where the other pilot, with Kirk leaving the galaxy and Sally Kellerman and what's his name, who I forget, being imbued with unbelievably superhuman powers that keep exponentially growing until they become, you know, unbeatable.
Yeah, they're just gods. Yeah,
that kind of thing. You know, but basically it was a, and I don't have a problem with it, but it was a universe occupied by human scale creatures, more or less, and there were no gigantic, unimaginable, cool intelligences out there in the universe other than a few that were thrown in as plot devices. And that's a shame, because science fiction lets you dream as big as the universe, and why not go for it?
Yep. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have more letters coming. We received a number of Science Fiction University letters this week, including one from our friend at Magnolia ePublishing.
Yeah.
Which we're going to get to next week. It's a Heinlein-based quiz show type thing. Ah. And I think you'll love it. But we're running out of time. So thank you, everybody. And have a great week. Okay.
Bye.